eating food and laying eggs, doing their thing, and I was able to finish in under 3 hours. By then, it was coming up on lunch, and thinking my morning had already been exceedingly productive, I treated myself to a beer with my sandwich. Sometimes, it just hits the spot. Know what I mean? After lunch, there were two more things on my agenda, both of which I considered important for my own peace of mind. Natalie had been right about the possibility of finding answers in my grandfather's truck. She was also smart to suggest that I call the hospital first. For all I knew, my grandfather had been transported from another county. I found the phone number on the internet and spoke to an older lady with an accent so thick it could have been bottled, who had absolutely no idea how to help. After hemming and hawing for a couple of minutes, in addition to her drawl, she spoke incredibly slowly. She finally landed on the name of one of the hospital administrators and offered to connect me. While doing so, unfortunately, I was cut off. I called again, asked for the appropriate name, and then was connected to voicemail. I left my name, number, a brief message, and asked him to return my call. Maybe because of the experience I'd had with the first lady, I wasn't all that certain I'd receive a call back. Even so, I felt like I'd just taken the first step on a journey to find the answers I needed. In the various phases of my life, high school, Annapolis, medical school, residency, and the Navy, I became friends with some extraordinary people. In each of those phases, I became particularly close to a small circle of individuals, and I simply assumed that I would remain close with them forever. Because we were hanging out then, my thinking went, we'd hang out forever. But friendships, I've learned, aren't like that. Things change. People change. Friends mature and move and get married and have children. Others become doctors and deploy to Afghanistan and have their careers blown up. Over time, if you're lucky, a few or maybe just a couple remain from each of the various phases of your life. I've been fortunate. I have friends who date back to high school, and yet I sometimes find myself wondering why some people remain in your life while others drift away. I don't have the answer to that, other than to observe that friendship has to flow both ways. Both of you have to be willing to invest in the friendship in order to maintain it. I mention this because I sometimes wonder whether to consider Dr. Bowen a friend. In some ways, he is. We speak every week, and he knows me better than anyone. He's the only person who knows how much I actually used to contemplate suicide after my injuries, daily if you're curious. And he's the only one who knows that I feel very low every year on the day my parents' plane crashed. He knows how much sleep I get, how many beers I drink in the course of a week, and how hard it used to be for me to control my anger in situations where I should have simply rolled my eyes and gone on with life. Once, about 9 months ago, I was standing in the checkout line at Home Depot when the next aisle opened up. The clerk there said he could help the next person in line, which was me, but the man behind me rushed over instead, taking what was rightfully my place. No big deal, right? Maybe an irritation, but what was really at stake? A few minutes? On a day when I wasn't really doing anything at all. The point is that it shouldn't have bothered me, but it did. I was bothered, then angry, and then, as the emotion continued to build, enraged. I stared at the back of his head with death rays, and I ended up walking out the door less than half a minute behind him. Watching him in the parking lot, I had to fight the visceral urge to chase after him and tackle him to the ground. I imagined pummeling him with my fists, even if I could make a fist with only one of my hands. I imagined driving a knee into his kidneys or his stomach. I visualized ripping his ear off, just as I'd lost mine. My jaw was set, my body bracing for confrontation, as I began to walk faster, when all of a sudden, it dawned on me that I was experiencing a symptom of PTSD, one that Bowen had repeatedly warned me about. I'd been in therapy for a while by then, and like a steady voice of reason, amid an orchestra of emotional noise, Bowen was telling me what to do, telling me to change my behavior. Stop and turn away. Force yourself to smile and relax the muscles. Take 5 long breaths. Feel the emotion and then let it go, watching as it dissipates. Weigh the pros and cons regarding the action you want to take. check the facts, and realize that in the broad scheme of things, what really happened doesn't matter at all. When my anger finally dissipated to a manageable level, I was able to drive home. Days later, I poured the whole story out to my doctor, but in the following months, I told none of my friends. Nor did I tell my friends about the nightmares and the insomnia or anything else that was making my life a trial. And I wondered, why can I tell Dr. Bowen, but not the people I consider friends? I suppose it has to do with fear. Fear of rejection. Fear of disappointing others. Fear of their anger or their judgment. This says more about me than it does them, but I don't feel this way when I speak with Dr. Bowen. I'm not sure why. Maybe it has something to do with the simple fact that I pay him. Or maybe it has to do with the idea that, for all our conversations, I know little about him. In that way, we're not friends at all. Because he wears a wedding ring, I assume he's married, but I have no idea who his wife is, or how long they've been married, or anything else about his wife at all. I don't know whether he has children. From the diplomas on the wall of his office, I know he went to Princeton as an undergraduate and Northwestern for medical school. But I don't know his hobbies, or the kind of house he lives in, the food he likes, or any books or movies that he may have enjoyed. In other words, we're friends, but really, we're not. He's just my therapist. Eyeing the clock, I saw it was almost time for our weekly call, so after rinsing my dishes in the sink, I propped open the back door for some fresh air and put the computer on the kitchen table. Dr. Bowen liked to see my eyes when we spoke, so he could tell whether I was lying or hiding something important. On my end, it was a lot easier than meeting him in person, and I had easy access to the bathroom if I had to go. No reason to put the session on hold, no matter what. I could just carry the computer with me while I did my business. Kidding. At the top of the hour, I logged into Skype, and it automatically dialed the number. When the connection was made, Dr. Bowen popped into view. As usual, he was at his desk in the office, a place I'd visited more times than I could count. Slightly balding, with round, wire-rimmed glasses that made him look more like a professor of mathematics than a psychiatrist, he was, I guessed, about a decade and a half older than I was. "What's up, Doc?"
"Hello, Trevor."
"How are you?"
"I'm fine, thank you. How are you?"
When I asked, it was simply part of a greeting. When he asked, he actually meant it. "I think I'm doing well," I answered. "No nightmares, no insomnia, sleeping well. I had one or two beers on four different days last week. I worked out five times. No episodes of anger or anxiety or depression in the last week. Still working the CBT and DBT skills whenever I feel like I need them."
"Great," he nodded. "Sounds very healthy."
He paused. Bowen did that a lot. Pause, I mean. "Should we keep talking?" I finally asked.
"Would you like to keep speaking?"
"Are you going to charge me?"
"Yes."
"Oh, I've got a new joke," I said. "How many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb?"
"I don't know."
"Only one, but the light bulb has to really want a change." He laughed, just as I knew he would. Bowen laughs at all my jokes, but then he gets quiet again. He's told me that jokes might be my way of keeping people at a distance. "Anyway," I began, and proceeded to catch him up on the basic goings-on in my life in the past week. When I'd first started therapy, I wondered how any of this could possibly be useful. I'd learned over time that it allowed Bowen to have a better idea about the stress I was under at any given time, which was important in my management of PTSD. Add too much stress, remove the skills and healthy behaviors, and it's either kaboom, like I felt toward the Home Depot guy, or way too much drinking and Grand Theft Auto. So I talked. I told him that I'd been missing my grandfather and my parents more than usual since I'd last spoken to him. He responded that my feelings were entirely understandable, that checking the hives and fixing the engine on the boat would likely have triggered a mix of nostalgia and feelings of loss for just about anyone. I mentioned that I was nearly certain that someone had broken into the house and had lived there. When he asked if I felt violated or bothered by that, I said that it was more curious than bothersome, since aside from the back door, there'd been no damage and nothing had been stolen. I also mentioned the things Claude had said about my grandfather. And, as we had so often of late, we spoke about my grandfather's last words and my ongoing confusion about them.
It still troubles you, he observed.
Yes, I admitted. It doesn't make sense.
Because he told you to go to hell?
Dr. Bowen, like Natalie, seemed to remember everything. It wasn't like him to say something like that, I insisted.
Maybe you misunderstood.
Bowen had suggested this before. As I had in the past, I dismissed it. I'm sure he said it.
But he also said that he loved you, correct?
Yes.
And you indicated that he'd had a major stroke and was on a lot of medication and was quite possibly confused.
Yes.
And that it took nearly a day for him to be able to speak any words at all?
Yes.
When I said nothing else, he finished with the same question that continued to plague me. Yet you still feel he was trying to communicate something important. On the monitor, Bowen was watching me. I nodded but said nothing. You do realize, he offered, that you may never understand what that might be.
He meant the world to me.
He sounds like a profoundly decent man.
I looked away. Through the open door, the creek was black and ancient in the soft southern light.
I should have been there, I muttered. I should have gone with him. If I had, maybe he wouldn't have had the stroke. Maybe the drive was too much for him.
Maybe, Bowen said, or maybe not. There's no way to know for sure. And while it may be normal to feel guilty, it's also important to remember that guilt is simply an emotion. And like all emotions, it will eventually pass, unless you choose to hold on to it.
I know, I said. He'd said this to me before. While I accepted the truth of it, it sometimes struck me that my emotions didn't care.
Anyway, Natalie said that I might find some answers in his truck, as to the reason he was in South Carolina, I mean. So I've begun the process of trying to find out where the truck is.
Natalie? He asked.
She's a deputy sheriff here in town, I began, then went on to tell him how we'd met and a little about our conversations at the park, at the house, and then finally at dinner.
You've spent quite a bit of time together since we last spoke, he responded.
She wanted to see the beehives.
Ah, he said, and because we'd spoken so frequently, I knew exactly what he was thinking.
Yes, I said, she's attractive and intelligent. And yes, I enjoyed our time together. However, I'm not sure how Natalie feels about me, which means there's not much else to add.
All right, he said.
I'm serious, I insisted. And besides, I suspect Natalie might be dating someone else. I'm not sure about that, but there are signs.
I understand, he said.
Then why does it sound like you don't believe me?
I believe you, he said. I simply find it interesting.
What's interesting?
Natalie is the first woman you've spoken to me about since you broke up with Sandra.
That's not true, I said. I told you about Yoga Girl.
She was a woman I'd gone out with twice the previous fall, right around the time I'd been accepted into the residency program. We'd had a couple of pleasant evenings, but both of us knew by the end of the second date that it wasn't going to work between us.
I watched as he pushed his glasses up on his nose.
I remember, he finally said, his voice coming out with a sigh.
And do you know what you called her when you first mentioned her to me?
I can't say that I do, I admitted. I also tried to remember her name. Lisa, Eliza, Elise, something like that.
You called her Yoga Girl, he said. You didn't use her name.
I'm sure I told you her name, I protested.
Actually, you didn't, he said. At the time, I found that interesting, too.
What are you trying to say? That you think I might be falling for someone in local law enforcement?
The corners of his mouth turned up slightly as we both noted the fact I'd suddenly avoided her name.
I have no idea, he went on, and that's not really for me to say one way or the other.
I don't even know if I'll see her again. The time on my computer showed, amazingly, that nearly an hour had already passed and that our session was about to come to an end.
Speaking of seeing each other, he added, I wanted to let you know that it's possible we could meet in person next week, unless you'd prefer to continue communicating electronically. You think I need to travel to Pensacola? No, not at all. Perhaps I should have been clearer. There's a conference at Camp Lejeune in Jacksonville concerning PTSD. One of the speakers, unfortunately, had to cancel, and I was asked to fill in. It's on Tuesday, but I have to fly up Monday. If you'd like, we could meet in Jacksonville, or I could come to New Bern, if that's easier. That would be great, I said. What time? Same time, he asked. I can catch a morning flight and rent a car. Are you sure it's not too far out of the way? Not at all. I'm looking forward to visiting your grandfather's place. You've painted quite a picture for me. I smiled, thinking that even if I had, I still hadn't done it justice. I'll see you next week, Doc. Do you need directions? I'm sure I'll be able to find it. Take care. 2 hours later, my cell phone rang. Though I didn't recognize the number, the area code was from upstate South Carolina. The hospital administrator? Trevor Benson, I answered. Hi, this is Thomas King from Baptist Easley Hospital. I received your message, but I wasn't exactly sure what information you needed. Unlike the receptionist, his accent wasn't nearly as thick or hard to understand. Thank you for returning my call, I started, before laying out the situation. When I finished, he asked me to hold for a moment. It was way longer than a moment. I listened to Muzak for at least 5 minutes before I heard the phone click through to him. I apologize that it took so long, but I had to find out who to ask and then find the information you needed. We generally use 2 ambulance services, he explained before giving me their names. As I wrote them down, he went on. Unfortunately, we don't have the particulars regarding your grandfather. I suppose your best bet is to call the ambulance services. Perhaps they'll have the information you need. I'm sure they're required to keep records. It was just as Natalie had suggested. I appreciate your help, I said. This is more than helpful. You're welcome, and my condolences for the passing of your grandfather. Thank you, I said. I hung up, thinking that I'd call the ambulance companies in the morning. I wished I had thought about it when my grandfather had been in the hospital. After nearly half a year, who knew how long it might take them to find the answers I needed? My thoughts turned to Natalie. Since my call with Bowen, images of her kept resurfacing in my mind. I saw her expression of wonder as she watched the bee crawl over her finger, the sensuous swirling of her dress outlining her long legs, and the graceful lines of her body as she stepped out of her car in Beaufort. I recalled both our heartfelt discussion and the easy banter between us, and I puzzled over the flash of sadness I thought I'd sensed toward the end of our dinner. I thought about the energy between us and knew exactly why I'd called her by her name when speaking with Bowen. As much as I'd tried to downplay it with Dr. Bowen, I knew with certainty that I wanted to see her again, sooner rather than later. After I'd had dinner, I resolved to finally get some reading done on the back porch. But figuring that Natalie would have finished her shift some time ago, I found myself reaching for my cell phone. I debated calling, but decided against it. Instead, I typed out a quick text. I was just thinking about you and hope you had a good day. Are you free for dinner this weekend? Though I should have set my phone aside, I waited to see if she was near enough to her phone to read the text right away. Sure enough, I saw the indication that she'd read the text and assumed she would write something back. Instead, there was no response at all. For the rest of the evening, I continued to check my phone. Childish, compulsive, maybe immature. At times, I can be all those things. Like Bowen says, we're all works in progress. Finally, just as I was getting ready to turn in for the night, I heard the telltale ding of my cell phone. Thanks. Typical day. Nothing special. I stared at the screen, thinking it didn't exactly proclaim an undeniable passion and attraction toward me, especially since she hadn't addressed my invitation at all. I put the phone on the bedside table, feeling confused, hurt, before reaching for the lamp. I shook those feelings aside, knowing it was way too early to feel either of those things. Besides, if she hadn't wanted to speak with me again, she wouldn't have answered at all, right? I turned out the light, then adjusted the covers, when I heard my cell phone suddenly ding again. I reached for the phone. I'll think about it. Not a yes, but not a no either. I continued to stare at the screen until it vibrated again with another message from her. Smiley face. I smiled. Clasping my hands behind my head, I stared at the ceiling, more curious about her than ever. Chapter 8. I didn't hear from Natalie on Tuesday, which disappointed me, but my offer was out there. I knew she was working and busy, and I had things to do as well. Well, sort of. But I didn't text her. It wasn't as though I was thinking about her all the time, just too much for my own good. I also spoke to both ambulance companies. As with the hospital, it took a couple of transfers before I was able to reach someone who could help. Yes, I was told, there were records of pickup locations for patients who had been transported to the hospital. No, I was told, they didn't have that information readily available. It would take them a few days to find it, maybe until the end of the week, and if I didn't hear from them, to call again. Hurry up and wait. Just like so many other things in life. Hoping for a chance to speak with Claude's father, I decided to visit the trading post for lunch. Pulling up, I spotted a bin offering bags of ice, firewood for sale, propane tank refills, an air compressor to fill tires, and an old-fashioned vending machine, which seemed redundant since people could purchase sodas inside. Unfortunately, there was no one out front in the rockers. Inside, Claude was back at his usual spot behind the register, and he raised a hand in greeting as I headed toward the grill. As usual, all the tables were occupied, so I found myself at the counter. A massive man, at least a head taller than me and twice as wide, nodded toward me before handing me a small bowl of boiled peanuts. I assumed this was Frank, the regular grill man. Unlike Claude, he said nothing. Not much of a chatter, which was fine with me. In honor of my grandfather, I ordered a BLT with fries and a pickle. Behind me, I overheard two guys at one of the tables talking about their fishing trip the weekend before, lamenting their lack of luck, and debating better places to try the following weekend. I peeked over my shoulder. Both were wearing baseball caps. One had the sinewy arms associated with construction, while the other wore a uniform of one of the propane distributors. When one of them mentioned that he had spotted an alligator recently, my ears perked up. "Four of them, actually," he went on. "Sunning right there on the bank between the trees."
"Big ones?" his friend asked.
"Nah, juveniles, probably."
"Where?"
"You know where the boat launch is? A couple of bends in the river after that on your right. You remember the bald eagle's nest in the cypress tree? Right around there."
"What eagle's nest?"
"Same nest as last year."
"I didn't see it last year."
"That's because you never take the time to look around."
"I'm fishing," he answered, "not sightseeing."
"You tried the quarry? I've had some luck with bass there lately." The conversation returned to fishing again, and I found myself tuning out. I was, however, interested in the alligators and the bald eagles and wondered if Natalie might want to join me. By then, my meal was ready, and Frank placed the plate in front of me. I took a bite, confirming that it never tasted as good anywhere else. I finished the sandwich and the pickle, but had only a few of the fries. I could feel my arteries hardening as I sampled them, but my taste buds were happy. As I was finishing up, I glanced through the windows toward the front of the store and saw a pair of elderly gentlemen sitting in the rockers on the porch. Just what I'd been hoping for. Rising from my seat, I approached the register. Claude, without the apron and shiny face, seemed far more content than he was the last time I'd been here. "Hey, Claude," I greeted him. "Is that your father out front?" He leaned forward to peek over my shoulder. "Yeah, that's him, the one with the overalls. The other guy's Gerald. Do you think your dad would mind if I spoke with him about my grandfather?"
"Feel free. Can't guarantee he'll know anything, assuming he even hears what you're asking."
"Of course.
Word of advice? Watch out for Gerald. Half the time I have no idea what he's talking about or what he finds so funny.
I wasn't sure what he meant exactly, but I nodded. How long do you think your father will be here?
They haven't eaten yet, so I reckon he'll be here at least another hour.
What does he usually have for lunch?
The barbecue sandwich with slaw and hush puppies.
How about I buy that for him?
Why? It's not like I can charge him. He still owns a portion of the store.
I figure if I'm going to try to get some information from him, it's the least I can do.
It's your money, he shrugged.
I pulled some cash from my wallet and handed it over, watching as he added it to the drawer. He cupped a hand at the corner of his mouth and called across the store.
Hey, Frank, get Daddy the usual, okay? And hand it to Trevor here. He'll bring it out.
The meal didn't take long to prepare, and when it was ready, I ferried the plate to the front door. As I passed the register, Claude loosened the cap on a Yoo-hoo, then tightened it slightly before holding it out to me.
You'll need this, too.
Yoo-hoo?
It's his favorite. He's been drinking it as long as I can remember.
I took the bottle, and with my hands full, I used my hips to push open the door. As I approached, Jim looked up, his face as gnarled and wrinkled as his hands, all bone and skin and liver spots. He wore glasses, and a few of his teeth were missing, but I thought I saw a spark of curiosity in his expression that made me believe he was sharper and more aware than Claude's description of him might indicate. Then again, maybe I was just being optimistic.
Hi, Jim. I thought I'd bring out your lunch, I started. I was hoping to talk to you for a few minutes.
Jim squinted up at me.
Huh?
Gerald leaned toward Jim.
Boy here wants to talk to you, Gerald shouted. Talk about what?
Jim asked.
How the hell should I know? He just walked out here.
Who is he?
Jim asked. Gerald swiveled his gaze toward me. He was younger than Jim, but still well past retirement age. I noticed a hearing aid, which might or might not make things easier. He leaned toward Jim again.
I'm figuring he's a salesman, Gerald shouted. Maybe selling them women's panties.
I blinked, unsure whether to be offended, and suddenly remembered what Claude had told me.
Tell him to talk to Claude, Jim said with a wave. I'm retired. I don't need nothing from any salesman.
The hell you don't, Gerald said to him. You need a woman, and one of them winning lotto tickets, if you ask me.
Huh?
Gerald leaned back in his seat with mirth in his eyes.
Women's panties,
he cackled, clearly pleased with himself.
You selling women's panties?
No, I said. I'm not a salesman. I just wanted to speak with Jim.
About what?
About my grandfather, I said. And I brought Jim his lunch.
Then don't just stand there.
He waved a bony hand at me.
Give it to him. Don't be slow now.
I leaned down and handed Jim his lunch. As I did, Gerald frowned, the grooves in his forehead so deep they could hold a pencil.
Where's my lunch? Gerald demanded.
I hadn't expected the question, but realized that I probably should have considered the idea they'd want to eat together. I'm sorry, I wasn't thinking. What would you like? I'd be happy to get you something. Gerald said, bringing a hand to his chin.
How about filet mignon with a lobster tail and lots of butter? With some of that rice pilaf.
Do they serve that here? I asked.
Of course they don't. You need to order it special from one of them fancy places.
I assumed he meant a different restaurant, a real restaurant, and I was caught off guard.
Where would I order that? I asked. What's he saying?
Jim asked. Gerald leaned toward Jim again.
He's saying he won't buy me lunch, Gerald shouted. And he says he'll buy you a Cadillac if you'll talk to him.
I blinked, wondering how I'd lost control of the conversation. A Cadillac? Where did that come from? I didn't say that, I protested. And I'd be glad to get you anything the grill offers. Gerald slapped his thigh, not letting me finish, before suddenly locking eyes with me again.
Boy, you as dumb as dirt. A Cadillac. What on earth would he do with a Cadillac? He can barely drive as it is.
He shook his head, cackling.
A Cadillac, he shouted to Jim.
Standing in place, I could think of nothing to say. Gerald didn't seem to need me to say anything. He was too happy with himself to care what I might be thinking. Jim, meanwhile, struck me as oblivious. I decided to seize the initiative. I was hoping to ask Jim about my grandfather, Carl Haverson. Gerald reached into his pocket and pulled out a bag of snuff. After opening the package, he pinched a few of the leaves together before placing them between his lip and gum. His mouth made a few contortions, and he settled back in the chair, looking like he had a tumorous growth in his jaw.
"You're telling me that you're kin to Carl?"
"He was my grandfather," I said again. "I'm trying to learn what he was doing in South Carolina. Claude said Jim and my grandfather were close, and I was hoping he could answer some questions."
"Might be hard," Gerald said. "Jim here, he don't hear too well, and he wanders when he talks. Half the time, you don't know what he means."
"I could say the same about you," I thought.
"It's important," I said instead. "Maybe you can help?"
"Don't know how."
"Did you know my grandfather? Did you speak with him before he left?"
"Sure," he drawled. "I got out here now and then and we'd talk. Not as much as Jim here, though. But then one week, he wasn't around, so it was just me and Jim. I was as surprised as anyone when I found out what happened to him. Carl was in good health, as far as I knew."
"How about the trip to South Carolina? Did you know anything about that?"
"He never mentioned anything about it to me."
"Was he acting differently? Anything like that?"
Gerald shook his head. "Not that I could tell."
I rocked back on my heels, wondering if I was wasting my time. Surprising me, Gerald slowly rose from the chair. He had to grip both arms, and moving into the vertical position seemed both laborious and painful.
"You two go ahead and visit," he said. "Maybe Jim knows something I don't. He knew Carl better than I did. But talk loud, toward his right ear. It barely works, but don't even bother trying with the left one."
"You don't have to leave," I said.
"You'll need my chair. He won't admit it, but he needs to be able to see your lips moving so he can figure out what you're saying. He'll get about half of what you say, so just keep trying."
"Where are you going?" Jim said.
"I'm hungry," Gerald shouted. "I want some food."
"Huh?"
Gerald waved him off and looked toward me.
"Don't just stand there looking dumb as a tree. Take a seat. I'll be back."
I watched as Gerald shuffled toward the door, and when he was safely inside, I sat in the same rocker, then leaned forward as Gerald had done.
"Hi," I shouted. "I'm Trevor Benson."
"River Fenson."
"Trevor Benson," I said again. "I'm Carl's grandkid."
"Who?"
"Carl," I said even louder, wondering if I should have kept Gerald around to translate.
"Oh, Carl," Jim said. "He passed on."
"I know. He was my kin," I said, hoping Gerald's phrasing would help. Jim squinted at me, and I could tell he was searching. It took a few beats.
"The Navy, Doc? You were married to Claire, right?"
"Yes," I said, even though Claire had been my mother. No reason to make it any more complicated than it already was.
"He sure liked those bees, old Carl," Jim added. "Had them a long time. Beehives. For the honey."
"Yes," I nodded. "I wanted to speak to you about Carl."
"I don't much like bees," he said. "Never could figure out what he saw in them."
Trying to keep it simple, I opted for the direct approach. "I have some questions that I was hoping you could answer." Jim didn't seem to hear me.
"Carl had a hard time with the honey last summer," Jim said. "Arthritis."
"He probably did."
"He got help from the girl, though,"
Jim added, not hearing me.
"Girl?"
"Yeah," Jim said. "The girl. Inside."
"Okay," I said, wondering what he was talking about. I hadn't seen any girls in the store today, but Claude had warned me his mind wandered. Leaving that behind, I leaned closer, speaking slowly and replicating Gerald's volume. "Do you know why Carl went to South Carolina?"
"Carl died in South Carolina."
"I know," I said. "Do you know why Carl went to South Carolina?" I asked again.
Jim took a bite of his sandwich and chewed slowly before answering.
I reckon he was going to visit Helen.
For a second, I wondered if he'd understood my question. Helen? He was going to visit Helen? I shouted.
Yep, Helen. That's what he told me.
Or was that what Jim had heard? How much could I trust his hearing? Or the competence of his memory? I wasn't sure.
When did he tell you about Helen?
Huh?
I repeated the question, even louder this time, and Jim reached for a hush puppy. He took a bite, and it took him a long time to finally swallow.
I reckon about a week or so before he left. He was working on the truck.
To make sure it could get there, no doubt. But who was Helen? How would my grandfather have met a woman from South Carolina? He had neither a computer nor a cell phone, and he rarely left New Bern. It didn't add up.
How did Carl meet Helen?
Huh?
Helen.
I reckon that's what he said.
Did Helen live in Easley?
Was Easley?
The town in South Carolina.
He picked up another hush puppy.
Don't know much about South Carolina. I was stationed there during the Korean War, but said good riddance as soon as I got out. Too hot, too far from home. The drill sergeant there, oh, what was his name? R something, like a joke.
As he was searching the past, I tried to figure out what he'd told me, assuming Jim wasn't completely bonkers. A woman named Helen was in Easley, and my grandfather had gone to visit her?
Riddle, Jim suddenly shouted. That's his name, Sergeant Riddle. Meanest, orneriest man there ever was. One time he made us sleep in the bog, dank and dirty, and so many mosquitoes. They bit all night till I swelled up like a tick. Had to go to the infirmary.
Did you ever meet Helen?
Nope.
He reached for his yoo-hoo, but even though Claude had loosened the cap, he struggled to open it. I watched as he took a drink, still trying to sort it out, but suspecting he had nothing else to offer.
Okay, I said. Thank you.
He lowered the bottle.
The girl might know more about it.
It took me a second to recall what he'd said earlier. The girl inside? He motioned with the bottle toward the window.
Can't remember her name. He liked her.
Helen?
No, the one inside.
I'll admit I was completely lost by then, and as if on cue, Gerald pushed out the door, carrying a plate similar to the one I'd brought out to Jim. Eastern North Carolina barbecue, which is flavored with vinegar and red pepper flakes, is different from barbecue anywhere else in the world. When Gerald was close, I stood from the chair, making room.
You two about done? He asked.
I thought about it, wondering what, if anything, I'd learned or how much of it was even real. Yes, I said. I think we're through.
I warned you he can wander a bit when he talks, Gerald admitted. Did you get the answers you needed?
I'm not sure, I said. He said my grandfather was going to visit Helen, and he mentioned something about a girl inside, but I have no idea what he was talking about.
I think I might have part of the answer to that.
What part?
The girl inside, Gerald said. He was talking about Callie. She and your grandfather were pretty close.
Claude was still at the register when I re-entered the store. There were a handful of customers in line, and I waited until he finished before approaching.
How'd it go? He asked.
Still trying to figure it out, I said. Do you know when Callie will be working again?
She's here now, Claude answered. But she's on break. She should be back in a few minutes.
Which explains why I hadn't noticed her earlier. Do you know where she is?
If she's not feeding the cat, she usually eats at the picnic table down by the dock, Claude said.
Thanks, I said, pushing back out the door again. Figuring it would be easier to talk while she wasn't on the clock, I rounded the side of the store to a path that led toward the creek. I knew there was not only a picnic table there, but also some gas pumps near the water's edge where boats could fill their tanks. I'd been there with my grandfather numerous times. The path wound through some trees and shrubbery, but when the view finally cleared, I saw Callie sitting at the table. As I crossed the grass, I noted the basic lunch she'd clearly brought from home. Peanut butter and jelly sandwich, container of milk, and an apple. Most of it nearly finished, in a brown bag. Hearing me approach, she glanced in my direction, then back to the creek again. "Callie?" I asked when I was close. "Claude told me that I might find you here." She turned her attention back to me, her expression wary. I wondered why she wasn't in school and noticed another bruise on her arm, close to the one I'd seen when she'd walked past my house. Instead of speaking, she took another bite of her sandwich, nearly finishing it. Remembering her general wariness, I stopped just short of the table, not wanting to crowd her. "I was hoping to speak with you about my grandfather," I said. "I heard that you helped him harvest the honey last summer." "Who told you that?" "Does it matter?" "I didn't do anything wrong," she said. Her comment caught me off guard. "I'm not implying that you did. I'm just trying to figure out why he went to South Carolina." "Why would you think I know anything about that?" "I was told that the two of you were close." Standing from the table, she shoved the last of her sandwich into her mouth and followed it with a final gulp of milk before stuffing the remains of her lunch into the bag. "I really can't talk right now. I have to get back to work, and I can't be late." "I understand," I said, "and I'm not trying to get you in trouble. Like I said, I'm just trying to figure out what happened to my grandfather." "I don't know anything," she repeated. "Did you help him harvest the honey?" "He paid me," she said, color rising like a stain in her pale cheeks. "I didn't steal any, if that's what you're asking. I didn't steal anything." "I'm sure you didn't. Why didn't you tell me that you knew him as well as you did?" "I don't know you or anything about you." "You knew I was related to him." "So?" "Callie, I didn't do anything wrong," she cried again, cutting me off. "I was walking by and he saw me and he asked me if I wanted to help him with the honey, so I did. It only took a couple of days, and after that I put the labels on and stacked them on the shelves. Then he paid me. That's it." I tried to imagine my grandfather asking her on a whim for help with the harvest, but for whatever reason, I couldn't. And based on the conversations we'd had to this point, I couldn't imagine her agreeing to such a thing either. At the same time, there was some truth there. She had, by her own admission, helped him harvest the honey. What, I wondered, was she not telling me? "Did he ever mention that he was going to visit Helen?" Her eyes suddenly widened, and for the first time, I thought I saw a flash of actual fear. As quickly as it came, however, it vanished with an angry shake of her head. "Well, I'm sorry about your grandfather, okay? He was a nice old man, and I was happy to help him with the honey. But I don't know anything about why he went to South Carolina, and I'd appreciate it if you just left me alone." I said nothing. She lifted her chin defiantly before finally turning around and heading back toward the store. On her way, she tossed the remains of her lunch into a garbage can without breaking stride. I watched her leave, wondering what it was that I'd said that had upset her so. Back at home, I considered what, if anything, I'd actually learned. Could I trust what Jim had told me? Or Gerald? Had my grandfather gone too easily because of a woman named Helen? And what was I to make of my conversation with Callie? What had I said to make her believe she was in trouble? I didn't know. And yet, as I continued to reflect on my encounter with Callie, I had the gnawing sensation that she'd said something, or I'd seen something, important. It was the answer to one of my many questions. But the harder I tried to zero in on it, the hazier my thoughts became. It felt like I was trying to grab a handful of smoke. Chapter 9. On Wednesday, while pondering my maybe but not guaranteed date with Natalie, I decided to take my grandfather's boat out to try to find the alligators and bald eagles I'd heard about the day before. I made a quick inspection before untying the lines and starting the motor. There were no other boats in the vicinity, which was fortunate, because I would need to get used to the steering again. I had no desire to participate in a water-based demolition derby, or accidentally run aground, so I gently eased the throttle, turning the wheel as I pulled away from the dock. To my surprise, the boat was a lot easier to maneuver than I remembered, which meant my grandfather must have done some work on it, and I was quickly able to get it headed in the proper direction, like the highly skilled Naval Academy graduate that I was supposed to be. As a kid, I always loved going out with my grandfather on the boat. But unlike most people who preferred the wider Trent and Neuse rivers, I always favored Bryce's Creek. Because the creek wound its way through the Croatan National Forest, it probably hadn't changed since settlers first arrived in the area in the early 1700s. In a way, it felt like traveling back in time, and when my grandfather shut down the engine, we would hear nothing but bird calls from the trees, while every now and then a fish would jump, making ripples on the otherwise black and silent water. I settled into the ride, keeping to the middle of the creek. As ugly as it was, the ride itself was surprisingly stable. My grandfather had built the boat the way he had because Rose was afraid of the water. As an epileptic whose seizures grew in frequency and intensity as she'd aged, she'd never learned to swim, so he designed something impossible to capsize or sink, with rails to keep her from falling overboard. Even then, it usually took some convincing for Rose to accompany him, so my grandfather often went alone, at least until my mom was old enough to join him. When I began spending my summers with him, we spent almost every afternoon on the water. Boating always seemed to put my grandfather in a contemplative mood. Sometimes he would tell stories about his childhood, which was far more interesting than my own, or talk about bees, or his work at the mill, or what my mom had been like as a child. Almost always, though, his thoughts would turn to Rose, melancholy settling over him like a familiar shawl. The older he got, the more he repeated himself, and by the time of my last visit, I'd heard all of his stories often enough to recite them by heart. But I would listen without interruption, watching as he lost himself in the memories, because I knew how much she'd meant to him. I had to admit, their story was charming. It harkened to a place and time I knew only from black and white movies, a world replete with dirt roads and homemade bamboo fishing poles, and neighbors who sat on their front porches to beat the heat, waving to passersby. After the war, my grandfather had first spotted Rose having a soda with her friends outside the drugstore, and he'd been so taken with her that he swore to his friends that he'd seen the woman he would one day marry. After that, he saw Rose everywhere, outside Christ Episcopal Church with her mother or strolling through the Piggly Wiggly, and she began to notice him as well. Later in the summer, at the county fair, there was a dance. Rose was there with her friends, and though it took him most of the evening to work up the courage to cross the floor to ask her to dance, she told him that she'd been waiting all night for him to do just that. They married less than 6 months later. They spent their honeymoon in Charleston before returning to New Bern to settle into their life together. He built the house, and both of them wanted a brood of children. However, perhaps because of Rose's condition, one miscarriage followed another, 5 in total over an 8-year period. Just when they'd given up hope, my mother was conceived, and the pregnancy went the distance. They considered my mom a gift from God, and my grandfather swore that Rose had never been more beautiful than when he saw mother and daughter together, playing hopscotch, or reading, or even standing on the porch, shaking dirt from the rugs. Years later, when my mom went off to college on a full scholarship, my grandfather told me that he and Rose enjoyed a second honeymoon, one that lasted until their very last day together. Every morning, he would head out early to pick Rose a bouquet of flowers. She would make breakfast, and the two of them would eat together on the back porch, while watching the mist rise slowly from the water. He would kiss her before heading off to work, and again when he returned at the end of the day. They held hands as they took their evening walk, as though touch could somehow make up for the lost hours they'd spent apart. My grandfather found her on the kitchen floor on a Saturday, after he'd spent an afternoon building additional hives. He took her lifeless body in his arms and held her. He cried for more than an hour before finally calling the authorities. He was so destroyed that for the first time ever, My mom took a month-long leave of absence from her practice and came down to stay with him. He spent part of the following year carving her headstone himself, and up until our last phone call, I knew he continued to visit her grave every single week. There was Rose and only Rose. He'd always sworn no one could ever replace her. There was no reason to doubt him, and I never did. Toward the end, my grandfather was more than 90 years old, with arthritis and a dying truck. He led a simple life that included tending to honeybees and tinkering with the boat, all the while cherishing the memories of a wife that he could never forget. I turned all these things over in my mind while my thoughts circled back to my conversation with Jim. I tried to reconcile Jim's comments with the grandfather I'd known, but simply couldn't do it. Despite what I'd been told, I knew with sudden certainty that my grandfather had never, nor would have ever, gone to South Carolina to visit a woman named Helen. I continued upstream, motoring from one curve to the next, eventually reaching the public boat ramp in the Croatan National Forest. Interesting tidbit about the forest, it's one of the few places in the world where you can find Venus flytraps and other carnivorous plants growing in the wild. My grandfather used to bring me out to search for them. Somehow, despite constant poaching, they're still relatively common. The boat ramp was one of the reference points I'd overheard at the trading post. Supposedly, the eagles and alligators were a couple of curves farther upstream, but for all I knew, it might be 0 or 10 curves. The guy's description had been a little vague, so I slowed the boat and scanned the trees on either side of the creek. The problem, I soon realized, was that I had no idea what I was supposed to look for. Technology, however, is a wonderful thing. Pulling out my phone, I did a quick internet search and was able to find images of bald eagles' nests. To my eye, they looked like regular birds' nests, only much larger, which made me feel foolish for not assuming that in the first place. In the end, I finally spotted it high in the branches of a cypress tree, a feat made even simpler by the fact that Mama or Papa Eagle was sitting in the nest, while the mate perched in the limbs of a nearby tree. It wasn't 2 bends in the river past the boat ramp, by the way, but 4. I stopped the boat and scanned the banks for the alligators, but had less luck there. I did note a cleared and muddy spot with some telltale burrows, however. Having lived in Florida, I had seen them before. Unfortunately, no alligators were around, but alligators were territorial, which meant it was likely that they'd return. In the meantime, my gaze was drawn toward the bald eagles, and I snapped some pics with my phone. With brown bodies and white heads, they looked just like the one on the Great Seal of the United States. My first sighting of them in the wild. It soon became rather boring, though. Aside from occasionally turning their heads, they didn't move much, and after a while, they were no more exciting to watch than the trees. I wondered if there were eggs in the nest, but I soon noticed a pair of baby eaglets. Every now and then, one or both of the little ones would poke up their heads, and I had the urge to tell someone about it. Reaching for my phone again, I typed out a quick message to Natalie. Do you have time to chat later? Again, I found myself watching the phone to see if she'd read it. To my surprise, her response came quickly. I'll probably have some time around 8. I smiled, thinking that things with Natalie were getting interesting. It wasn't exactly my grandfather and Rose, but definitely interesting. There was still no word from the ambulance companies, but I figured that I'd give them until Monday before I contacted them again. Despite that, the rest of my afternoon was productive, if you consider taking a long nap after a leisurely boat ride productive. For dinner, I decided to eat at Morgan's Tavern. Located downtown, it was my kind of place. Wood floors, lots of rustic brick, high-beamed ceilings, and an extensive menu. It was bustling, so I ended up sitting at one of the tables in the bar. But the service was quick, and the food was tasty. A good place to kill time until I called Natalie. Not wanting to be too punctual, I dialed 7 minutes after the hour. Perhaps not wanting to appear too eager, Natalie answered on the 4th ring, Oh, the silly games people play. Hey there, I said. How was work? Fine, but I'm glad I'm on days for the next few weeks. It's hard for me to sleep when the sun is shining. My body just doesn't like it.
You should do a residency. Then you never have to sleep at all.
She giggled. What's going on?
You'll never guess where I went today, I said.
You called because you want me to guess?
No, I said. I went out on the creek today.
On your grandfather's boat?
I prefer to think of it as a yacht.
Ah, she said, amusement in her voice.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I was hunting for alligators.
Don't tell me you found one.
I didn't, but I'm pretty sure I know where to find them.
I was thinking we might try to find them on Saturday. We could take the boat out, maybe follow that up with dinner at my place. How does that sound?
A second of silence on the line. Then, won't it be crowded on the water this weekend?
Your grandfather's boat draws way too much interest from others, she didn't have to add, and I'd prefer that no one else know I'm spending time with you.
Not where we'd be going. We'll be heading up the creek, probably in late afternoon. It's usually pretty quiet, and afterward, we'd eat at my place. I can grill a mean steak.
I don't eat red meat.
Natalie, I was beginning to learn, seldom offered a simple yes or no, but I was growing used to it.
I can grill seafood if you'd prefer, I suggested. Seafood's okay, right?
Yes.
Then how about coming by around 4:30? We'll spend a couple of hours on the boat, head back, fire up the grill, maybe open a bottle of wine. And I promise that even if we don't find the alligators, you'll see something pretty amazing.
What is it?
It's a surprise. What do you think?
4:30?
We could go earlier, but I wouldn't go later, or we'll lose the daylight when we're on the water. In the silence that followed, I tried and failed to imagine her as she was speaking. Where was she? In her kitchen? The family room? Her bedroom? Finally, I heard her voice again.
All right, she said, still sounding hesitant. I guess I should drive to your place?
If you'd rather, I could pick you up.
That won't be necessary, she said.
Because you don't want me to know where you live?
Great, I said, ignoring that internal query.
A couple of questions. Are you okay with tuna?
That's fine.
And my odds that you show are better than 50-50 this time?
Haha, she said. I'll be there at 4:30.
Maybe I was just imagining it, but I think there was a little part of her that was flattered by my persistence.
Good night, Trevor.
Good night, Natalie. On Thursday, I heard from the first of the ambulance companies, who let me know that they hadn't attended to or transported my grandfather. On Friday, I heard from the second one and struck pay dirt. After a brief conversation, I was emailed a scanned copy of the report. I read that my grandfather, Carl Haverson, had been picked up near mile marker 7 on Highway 123, and transported to Baptist Easley Hospital. Though light on details, the report showed that he was unconscious, with a thready pulse. Oxygen was administered en route, and he reached the hospital at 8:17 a.m. It wasn't much information, and told me little that I didn't already know, other than the pickup location. A quick search on the internet, including Google Earth, showed a stretch of highway near a dilapidated strip mall, which didn't add any helpful information, primarily because I had no idea of what exactly had led to the call in the first place. He could have been walking to his truck, or already driving, or heading into a restaurant. I didn't know who'd called the ambulance, or even what near mile marker 7 actually meant. Perhaps the only way to find the answers to any of these questions was to go there and check it out. But noting the time of his arrival triggered an additional thought, one that I should have realized before. Easley was at least 6 hours away by car. In my grandfather's truck, at his age, it might have taken him as long as 9 hours to get there. Had he driven through the night? Try as I might, I couldn't imagine that. He was, and always had been, an early riser. In my mind's eye, I could visualize him getting into the truck early in the morning, after sleeping in a hotel or motel.
Where, then, had he stayed the night? Near Easley? Farther east? Also, if he'd been found near the truck, I knew there was no way it would still be sitting alongside the highway, not after 6 months. So how was I going to find it? I wrestled with the questions on and off the rest of the day, without answers. What I did finally come to accept, however, was that a road trip to Easley was in my very near future. To understand what had happened to my grandfather, I knew I had no choice but to go there. Chapter 10. Saturday felt like early summer, at least while I was out for my run. By the time I finished, I was able to wring the perspiration from my shirt before showering, which was kind of gross, but reminded me of the years I'd actually been an athlete, as opposed to a guy who was simply trying to keep his pants from nipping at the waist. After breakfast, I cleaned the house again, paying special attention to the kitchen and bathrooms, then hauled the small dining room table and chairs out to the back porch. I rearranged the rockers, slid the grill to a new spot, and rifled through the cabinets and closets for a tablecloth and candles, doing my best to create a subtly romantic ambiance. Getting the boat ready was more of a chore. While I didn't care whether the recliners were ratty or moldy, I figured she might, and I had to run to the store to buy the cleanser I needed. After detouring to the grocery store, I then took the boat to the gas pumps at the trading post to fill the tank, but it took longer than expected due to the long line. 3 different people whipped out their phones to take photographs of me while I was in the queue, being that I was so handsome and all. Then again, maybe they were more interested in the boat. Who knew? I set the table, added flowers from the front yard to the vase, put the bottles of wine in the refrigerator to chill, chopped vegetables, and tossed a salad. I loaded the cooler with ice, beer, soda, and bottles of water, and ferried it to the boat, along with a snack platter. By that point, it was mid-afternoon. I tried and failed to remember the last time it had taken me so long to get ready for a date. I showered for the second time that day, and considering the sultry temperature, my instincts told me that shorts and a t-shirt would be most appropriate for the boat. Instead, I opted for jeans, a blue button-up shirt, and topsiders. I rolled up my sleeves and hoped the breeze would keep me from sweating through my shirt. I should have listened to my instincts. Natalie showed up a few minutes later, stepping out of her car in jean shorts, sunglasses, sandals, and a Rolling Stones t-shirt, a casually sexy appearance that registered immediately. I swallowed hard. After collecting a medium-sized canvas bag from the passenger seat, she turned, stopping in her tracks when she saw me. "I thought you said we were going on the boat." "We are," I said. "This is my captain's uniform."
"You're going to get hot."
"Yes, I am," I thought, already feeling the sun beating down on me.
"I'll be fine."
Approaching her car, I was unsure whether to lean in for a hug or stand in place like an idiot. I opted for the latter. She acted equally uncertain, which made me wonder whether she was as nervous as I. I doubted it, but it still made me feel better.
"I wasn't sure if I should bring anything," she said, motioning to the car, "but I have a small cooler in the back seat with drinks."
"I put some in the boat already, but I'm happy to load what you brought, just in case." Opening the back door, I retrieved the cooler.
"How's your day been?" she asked as we walked toward the house.
"Relaxing," I lied. "You?"
"Typical Saturday."
"Farmer's market?"
"Among other things."
She shrugged.
"Do you really think we'll find an alligator?"
"I hope so," I said, "but no guarantees."
"If we do, it'll still be a first. That's always kind of exciting."
"What's in your bag?"
"Clothes for later," she said. "I didn't want to get cold."
Frankly, I would have been happy if she stayed in the outfit she was wearing, but I kept quiet. I pushed the front door open. "Come on in. Feel free to leave your bag anywhere."
"How long do you think we'll be on the boat?"
"Hard to say, but we'll definitely be back before dark." She dug out some sunscreen from her bag while following me through the house and onto the back porch. When she saw all I'd done, she arched an eyebrow.
"Wow," she said.
You've been busy.
My parents raised me to make a good impression.
You already have, she said, or I wouldn't have agreed to come.
For the first time in her presence, I was at a loss for words. I think she knew she'd thrown me because she laughed.
All right, she went on. Let's get on the boat and find some alligators.
I led the way down to the dock, setting her cooler next to mine as we climbed on board. The boat rocked slightly under our shifting weights.
I've never been on a yacht before, she cooed, picking up the thread of my earlier joke. I hope it's safe.
Don't worry, she's seaworthy. I hopped back on the dock briefly to untie the ropes, then rejoined her, asking, would you like a beer or a glass of wine before we get going?
A beer sounds good.
I reached into my cooler and pulled out a Yingling. Twisting off the cap, I handed it to her. I opened a beer for myself as well, privately celebrating our first drink together. I held my bottle toward her.
Thank you for coming, I said.
Cheers. She tapped her bottle against mine before taking a small sip.
This is good, she commented, inspecting the label.
Wasting no time, I moved to the stern and started the engine with a pull of the cord. Back in the cockpit, I increased the throttle and inched away from the dock. I made my way toward the middle of the creek, grateful for the breeze. I could already feel a thin sheen of perspiration beginning